shouts, "After all I have given for you!" He staggers toward the fire. "For you, my son, I created the most spectacular shows. I gave you all that you asked. I washed the blood from your guilty hands time after time, and I gave you everything." Phipps pulls a blazing branch from the fire. "Enough is enough," he proclaims to the stars. "Enough!" He lifts the branch above his head and brings it down upon Merrin's jar. The glass shatters and the water floods out, and Merrin lies helpless on spilled pearls and glass shards. Her mouth is open in the shape of a scream. Her body flops like a beached fish's. "No!" I cry. "No! She must not die like this, alone and afraid, suffocating for want of water." "The show is over, son," Dr. Phipps shouts as he wobbles and swerves his way toward the wagons. He brandishes the makeshift torch and sets the large wagon ablaze with it before tossing it through the open door of the small wagon. "By the flames of hell, I disown it and you, Jasper. The devil take you both. You were more his son than mine."
As the doctor paces and rants about demons and betrayals, flames engulf the wagons, roaring and crackling and sending black smoke into the starry sky. I rush to Merrin and scoop up her doll-sized body.
"Merrin! Merrin!"
I say desperately. She grips my arm with a tiny hand and shuts her eyes.
"You must not die, sister. Please hold on."
I hurry to a bucket of water near the campfire, and I set Merrin inside. It is a tight fit, but for now it must suffice. Carrying the bucket tight against my breast, I run to a cluster of bushes and hide it under the lowest branches.
"Wait for me,"
I say to Merrin. One tiny pearl rolls down her sunken cheek.
"O'Neill is hurt and I must go back for him. Are you listening, Merrin? Do not die, sister. Rest and wait for us to return, understand?"
She nods. I run. The flames leap above us, tongues of fire trying to lick the stars from the heavens. Dr. Phipps's maniacal laughter sends chills through my body, but it occurs to me that I am not at all afraid. I am beyond fear's reach. I will do what I must to save O'Neill. I run past Jasper, who's still rolled up like a scared hedgehog, muttering. My draft has not worked after all. No wonder Auntie found me a frustrating student. Phipps grabs Soraya by the hair and drags her along the ground. She moans faintly as her veil slips off and her beautiful yellow sari snags on sharp stones. Between her breasts, like a hideous flower, a blood stain blossoms. The bullet that pierced O'Neill must have passed through his body and into hers.
"Look, woman,"
Phipps says as he yanks her into a sitting position.
"Your life is in flames, ruined by your treachery and your son's wickedness."
He looks down at her then, with the smug face of a pitiless conqueror. But his whole aspect changes when he sees the spreading blood. He is transformed from vanquisher to vanquished in the blink of an eye.
"My darling Soraya,"
he cries as he falls to his knees.
"My love!"
He draws her limp body into his arms and covers her with kisses. Deep, heaving sobs reduce him to a shuddering heap.
"O'Neill!"
I crouch beside him and gently pat his pale cheek. He opens his eyes.
"Come," I whisper. "We must get away."
"The doctor is mad,"
O'Neill says as I haul him to his feet.
"The seven needle root has turned his brain."
"And you are wounded,"
I say. "Now be quiet and come along." He takes a halting step, leaning heavily on me.
"Where do you think you are going?"
Jasper says from behind us. I turn. His gun is pointed at my head.
"Please,"
I beg. Let us go. The show is over, and you do not need us anymore.
Oh, but I do need you. I will make a new show, The Great Jasper and Company. But if you would prefer not to join me, O'Neill and the mermaid's names will go here,
he says, pointing to his left thigh.
And I will put your name here, Clara darling.
He pats his right thigh.
So that even in memoriam, you shall be parted from your sister and your lover. It is your choice to make. I do not wish to kill you, truly. But if you insist on opposing me, you will leave me no other option.
O'Neill's body goes limp as he faints. Unable to support his weight, I slump to the ground, settling him next to me as carefully as I can. I look up at Jasper. Around his throat hangs a very familiar gold locket and chain. That is Merrin's locket, I say, scrambling to my feet.
Yes, and inside the locket is the eye stone we used to track you, so that we could possess the mermaid. Mama knew from the first time she saw Merrin that she would become a valuable commodity. She sold the eye stone to Merrin's stupid suitor, and the rest is, as they say, history.
His grin is pure evil.
Did you set fire to our caravan? I ask, my voice trembling with anger and disgust.
It was a shame to destroy that splendid conveyance, but I did rescue you, didn't I? You should be grateful. Could you show me gratitude, Clara? Could you try to love me?
His gun is still aimed between my eyes. His expression is one of yearning mingled with madness.
I adore you, Clara. You have bewitched me. If only you would allow me to teach you the deep secrets of the night, you would forget all there was before. We could begin a new and exciting life together. What do you say, Clara?
I say you should go to the devil, Jasper Phipps.
I hear the whoosh of wings, followed by a piercing shriek. Osbert's claws root themselves in Jasper's scalp, and his sharp teeth lodge in the muscles of his shoulder. The gun falls to the ground with a clatter.
Get off!
Jasper shouts, slapping and pulling at Osbert's talons. A shadow passes between us and the moon. The shadow of another wyvern. I hold my breath as the great wyvern swoops lower and lower. This dragon is no house pet. He would not fit inside the door of any house. The monstrous wyvern shrieks again, and Osbert releases Jasper and moves aside. When I see the great wyvern's jaws open wide enough to swallow a horse, I squeeze my eyes shut. Cracking and crunching and gulping come from where Jasper once stood. Shivering, I open my eyes. Jasper is gone, vanished, as if he'd never existed. Not a scrap of clothing has been left behind, not a shoe or a fingernail. The big wyvern belches with satisfaction.
Great gods above!
Dr. Phipps cries, cowering beside Soraya's lifeless body.
It has come to pass!
Both wyverns turn and eye him. Red drool drips from the big one's bared fangs.
Osbert, no, I say. Your friend must not eat the doctor. Please, Osbert, I have seen enough violence.
Osbert nods at the beast, and it whines in disappointment. It spreads its massive wings and lifts from the ground with a rush of wind.
No!
Phipps cries as it circles above us. When the monster dives toward him and roars, Phipps clutches his heart and screams,
Have mercy!
And then his eyes roll back in his head and his mouth slackens. His body crumples onto Soraya's, and I know that he has joined his wife in death. Osbert scampers over and drenches my face with kisses. He kisses O'Neill until he awakens from his faint. And then our pet wyvern unfolds his wings and takes flight, following his fellow wyvern into the night with a happy waggling of his barbed tail. I sink to the ground beside O'Neill, and he lays his head in my lap.
"My brave Clara,"
he says. I do not feel brave. I feel 100 years old and very, very tired, yet wide awake with worry. My mermaid sister sits in a shallow bucket, growing weaker by the minute, and O'Neill has been shot and can barely stand. The smell of burnt wood and cloth and singed metal lurks about us as the wagon's contents smolder and crackle. The smoke forms wispy clouds above us, obscuring the stars and dimming the moonlight.
"The horses," O'Neill says. "I tethered them over there."
He points to the east.
"Just beyond that hill, in a patch of grass. If you bring them, we can leave this place. We can finally take the road to the sea."
He speaks boldly, but his forehead is creased with pain. "Yes," I say, "but first I must tend to your wounds." With unsteady fingers, I unbutton his shirt and peel the blood-soaked fabric from his skin. "I need more light," I say. "I cannot see the wound properly." All I can see is dark blood oozing steadily from a hole in his chest. "Can you move closer to the fire?"
"If you will help me,"
he says. His breathing is not right. Too much blood dampens my dress as I help him stumble to the fireside. I kneel beside him. The firelight shows me what I do not wish to see. Far too much blood. His color is wrong, his breathing ragged.
"The bullet passed through, did it not?"
he says. "Yes," I say.
"Yet I do not think I will live to see the sunrise, Clara,"
he says. He grips my hand.
"You will,"
I say.
"I must tell you some things before I go."
"You are not going," I say. I pull the dagger from my pocket and unsheathe it. "What it cuts, it mends," I say, repeating Mrs. Smith's words.
"It is a healing blade. I did not recognize it before." "You must use it on Marin, not me,"
O'Neill says. His skin is gray now, as gray as a corpse's.
"Make her a girl again. Save her for my sake. Keep my promise for me."
"The blade can only be used once," I say.
"Please, Clara, if you love me at all, if you love Marin, let her be the one to live."
How can I choose between the two people I love most? But if I choose healing for Marin, she would still be a mermaid, for there is no dagger in the universe that can make her a girl again. This is the truth I know and believe, although O'Neill continues to reject it again and again. In choosing Marin, I would likely lose them both, for Marin would regain her size, and without O'Neill, how could I carry her and keep her concealed until we reach the sea? There is no choice to be made. O'Neill must live, or the mermaid will surely perish. My hand trembles as I press the blade into his wound. What if Mrs. Smith was mistaken? What if I kill my dearest friend? He coughs and wheezes. His eyes roll back and he shudders. I cut him, tracing the bullet hole with the razor-sharp tip of the dagger. O'Neill whimpers, and then he is quiet and absolutely still. Chapter 28. I am certain O'Neill is dead. I have hastened his death, and Marin's death will follow swiftly. "I am sorry," I say. I lift his hand to my lips and kiss his cold skin. There is so much I want to say, but I do not think he will ever hear another earthly thing. I lay his hand upon his chest, inches from the ugly, seeping hole I helped create. The wound hisses and glows. The skin stretches to cover the wound, and all traces of blood evaporate in a pink puff of air. A crooked smile spreads across O'Neill's face just as the moonlight breaks through the clouds of smoke. If every joy of my life could be combined into one great joy, it would still be nothing but a shadow compared to this. My dearest O'Neill, living and breathing, and attempting to wipe away my flooding tears with his beautiful, filthy fingertips. The dawn is dim and misty, holding all the promise of another stifling day. The horses whinny as I untie them from their posts. I am glad that O'Neill tethered them away from the camp last evening. I am glad they are not now cinders like the Phipps's many treasures. From the six horses, O'Neill chooses Plato and Cleopatra for our journey, and sells the other four to a local farmer for much less than they are worth. We then return half the money to him in exchange for saddles, blankets, a sack of salt, and his promise to bury Soraya and Dr. Phipps, victims of an unfortunate accident. With all of his former vim and vigor, O'Neill vaults onto the back of the piebald horse. I hand him a large bucket covered with a piece of burlap, and he receives it as the priceless gift it is. He ties a length of strong rope about his waist and the bucket, and makes a good, tight knot.
"I will not lose Marin now," he says, "not after all we have been through."
I force a smile and use the fence to climb into the saddle of the chestnut mare.
"Ready?"
O'Neill asks. His face is so bright and eager that I wonder if the healing blade contained some kind of mood-lifting magic.
"Yes," I say. "It is half true. I am ready to deliver Marin to her home, but I am not ready to part with her. I will never be ready to be parted from my sister."
O'Neill commands his horse to walk, and my horse follows. We take the road to the east. My sister is a mermaid. She is small enough to sleep within a 2-quart jar of salt water. Yesterday, when the sun was noon high, I bought the jar from an old woman we met along the eastward leading road, filling it with fresh, clear water from her well and salt from her pantry. O'Neill guessed the woman's favorite song and sang it through 3 times, making her laugh and cry simultaneously. For this, she gave us a loaf of warm bread and a thick slab of cheese. As we left, she asked O'Neill to marry her. He declined, of course.
"Alas," he said sweetly, "my heart is not mine to give."
Today, the horses carry us as if we are no trouble at all, as if they are merely going where they please. O'Neill rides Plato with the grace of a prince, and I manage not to fall off Cleopatra's muscular back. O'Neill keeps Marin's jar tied to his body as we travel. He talks to her often, although she rarely responds. He sings to her until his voice is hoarse. Let him cherish her while he may. She is almost home now. The soil becomes sandier with each passing mile. The trees here are not like Lanfair Mountain trees. They are silly-looking pines, skinny, knobby trunks, and branches with sparse tufts of needles. And when we stop to rest the horses, O'Neill points to the cloudless sky. I recognize the white and gray bird above us. It was Marin's favorite in Auntie's bird book, the ring-billed gull. O'Neill loosens the knotted rope and lifts Marin's jar.
"Look, Marin," he says with the radiant joy of a little boy. "A seabird!"
Her eyelids flutter and she nods. She is so small now, just a handful. A miniature doll with tiny scales and smooth, pale blue-gray skin.
"We will be there soon,"
he says.
You will finally have what you have been longing for, dearest.
She is asleep again before he finishes speaking. My heart aches for his loss, and for mine. We sit in the rough, dry grass beside the road. I scan the sky for seabirds while O'Neill holds Marin's jar between his knees and stares at her wistfully.
I will ask the Sea King to release her, he says. I will demand that he restore her to her human family.
How many times have I told him that Marin is a mermaid? That she was never meant for the land? How can I say it again? I tear a piece of grass from the ground and use it to poke at an ant.
You will keep your sister, he says with conviction, even if I must trade my life for hers.
I stand and wipe the sandy soil from my dress.
Wishing gets you nothing,
I say. The words are bitter on my tongue, but I do not know what else to say to him.
I am not wishing, Clara. I am telling you the truth.
Your truth is not the truth, I say. I want to lie down on the sandy ground and go to sleep for 100 years, to wake up after the world has righted itself somehow.
Do you regret using the healing blade on me instead of her?
He asks.
Is that why you are angry with me? Or are you still holding a grudge against me for kissing you? Will you never forgive me?
I am tired, O'Neill. I am tired, and we are wasting time here. I walk to Cleopatra and rub her black nose. Help me up, will you? He cups his hand, I step into it, and he boosts me onto the horse's back. He looks up at me and says,
I am sorry, you know. Sorry for offending you so greatly.
I know that, I say. I close my eyes and wait for him to mount Plato. The coming end of Merin's journey fills me with dread. My heart is a tangled knot of love and hate and hope and despair. If I were a stork, life would be much simpler. When I return to Lanfair Mountain, perhaps I will ask Auntie how to hasten my change. As we ride, I remember the only time I have visited the ocean. The summer Merin, O'Neill, and I were 7 years old. Scarf brought us in the caravan, and he parked it behind a dune when we arrived. When the clanging and ringing of the pots and chimes all but ceased, the sound of the roaring waves filled my ears. We joined hands, 3 almost siblings, and with feet slipping in the sand, ran over the dune to see the water. We stopped, all of us as one. As soon as we could see the ocean spread out before us, vast and blue-green and powerful. The curling waves caught sunlight in their bellies before bending over it and crashing onto the beach. The seabirds called and dove above us. I remember happiness, as pure and sweet as any in my life, filling every part of me. O'Neill shouted for joy. And then Merin tore her hand free of mine and returned to the caravan in tears. 3 days we camped there. Merin, who practically lived in the pond and creek at home, refused to set foot in the ocean. All day she sat on the dunes and wept quietly while O'Neill and I splashed and swam and collected shells. Did she cry because she already knew that one day the ocean would take her away from us? Or did her sorrow stem from a soul-deep longing for the ocean to be her home even then? The road before us becomes sand, and the scent of seawater taints the warm breeze. Cleopatra follows Plato, her mane ruffling in the wind. Gulls screech above us as we top a small, grassy hill, and then we arrive. It is as I remember, beautiful and untamable and wider than my vision. I grip the reins and hold back tears. O'Neill brings Plato alongside me. After a few minutes of silence, I say,
"What do we do? Should there not be a ceremony or trumpet blasts or an earthquake or something? A rainbow?"
"I don't know,"
he says.
"I never considered this part."
I look at him from the corner of my eye. The blood stains on his torn shirt have faded after days in the sun. His hair is dirty from travel and more thatch-like than usual. Now that we are here, everything about him says sadness. On the horizon, a pod of dolphins swim together. Closer and closer they come, splashing and leaping in arcs above the water. "Dolphins," I say, pointing them out to O'Neill. He shades his eyes with one hand and squints.
"No,"
he says.
"Those are mermaids and mermen coming to meet Meryn."
"My sister," I whisper.
We dismount and walk down the beach as they continue their approach. Soon, we hear them singing, high and sweet and unearthly. I remember ruined sailors and glance at O'Neill.
"Be careful," I warn. "They might take you in spite of your tattoo. Can it protect you from so many of them?"
But perhaps that is what he wishes for in his heart of hearts, for then he and Meryn would never be parted. A bare-chested merman, his bronze hair adorned with a wreath of sea stars, lifts a conch shell to his lips and blows. The singing ceases, the waves calm, and a towering, majestic figure moves through the crowd of merfolk. They bow as they make way for their king. He grips a golden trident in his right hand. His hair and beard are rolling waves of silver, and his crown is a monument of gold and pearls, coral and sparkling sea glass.
"Come into the water,"
he commands in a voice like the roaring tides.
"Bring my daughter to me, for I have waited long to welcome her home."
O'Neill unties the rope and drops it onto the beach. He holds the jar to his side with one arm and offers me his other hand. Together, we wade through the fizzling foam and into the cool water. When the water sloshes at my waist, we stop.
"She is here, Your Majesty,"
O'Neill says as he raises the jar. The mermaids gasp and cry when they see her, so small and listless in her jar. It may be too late.
"Silence!"
the Sea King commands. The ocean stands still.
"Bring me the jar, Varun,"
he says to the muscular, golden-haired prince beside him. The prince glides through the water with grace and speed and reaches out pearlescent hands to receive the precious jar.
"Wait!"
O'Neill shouts.
"Must you take her, Your Majesty? She has a family who love her and a good life on land. Please do not take her from us."
"The jar,"
Varun says.
"Give it to me."
"She is my daughter,"
the king says. His voice is a tidal wave consuming a rocky island.
"She is a princess of the merfolk. She has never belonged to the human world. Her time there is done."
Varun pulls the jar out from O'Neill's grasp and swims swiftly to the king. O'Neill's hand trembles in mine. From fear or anger, I am not sure. I cannot bear to look at his face now. The king opens the jar and pours its contents, including Meryn, into his mighty palm. Then he lowers Meryn into the ocean. She disappears beneath the surface. I hold my breath, imagining her bobbing up like a dead fish. I grip O'Neill's hand desperately. Slowly, A head of bright copper hair emerges, followed by Merin's twinkling face and alabaster shoulders. She is full-sized again, and she is perfect. Her hair cascades over her round breasts and floats about her delicate waist like metallic seaweed. She laughs with the sound of waves caressing a sandy shoreline, and the merfolk rejoice.
Daughter,
the Sea King says, his august voice heavy with emotion. She embraces him without hesitation.
How we have longed for your return.
A dozen mermaids rush to surround her, crowning her with coral, slipping necklaces of shells about her neck, adorning her fingers with rings, brushing her hair with jeweled combs.
Wait!
O'Neill shouts above the joyful din.
Take me instead!
No, O'Neill. Merin turns to address us, and the crowd becomes silent. You must go home and live your life. This is my true home. It always has been.
Your friends may visit our kingdom once a year, in your month of June, during our festival of the Great Whales,
the king says to Merin. He gazes upon her with fatherly love. She is my sister, and he is my brother, Merin says. They have risked their lives to bring me home to you.
They shall be rewarded,
the king says. He waves his trident, and a pair of sea turtles swim to us, bearing a chest so large it covers both their shelled backs.
When you visit our palace, you shall receive even greater gifts for all you have done for my daughter.
May I say goodbye to them, father? Alone? Merin asks. He nods, then raises his trident again. The merfolk move toward the horizon, diving and surfacing with glad shouts and merriment. The ocean resumes its ebbing and flowing. When she comes to embrace me, her skin is warm and emanates the fragrance of seagrasses and strange flowers, salt and seashells. There is weight to her and strength. She is whole again, healthy and happy. I will miss you, I say into her ear. Every day, I will miss you, and I will miss you. Never was there a better sister, or a braver one. She releases me and takes O'Neill into her arms. If only you had been born in a seashell, she says, we could have made a home together beneath the waves. O'Neill shakes his head.
You will find a merman to marry. You will be happy. I know it,
he says with great effort. He does not wipe away the tears flowing from his eyes. They fall into the ocean to join the salt water of the ages. She kisses his cheek, and then mine. And then she dives into the swelling waves and swims away. We watch her go. We do not move until the rising tide forces us back to the shore. Chapter 29. O'Neill and I spread our blankets on the sand, on opposite sides of the driftwood campfire. Neither of us has spoken since Merin swam away. I lie awake and watch the stars turn above me. The ocean rolls and roars, splashes and murmurs. I cannot hear the voices of the merfolk anymore. I almost wonder if I imagined them. But if they were not real, then what has become of my sister? Inside my heart, an ocean of tears swells and crashes, yet I do not cry. I feel as if part of me is now made of sorrow, some new and tender organ that will pain me until the day I die. I know Merin is safe and well, and made beautiful in all ways. My grief is not for her, but for myself, because I miss her, because she is missing from me. No matter how many times I remind myself that I will see her again, the pain remains. In the morning, I walk along the shore and dig up clams with a stick. I carry them in my skirt, foregoing my manners and exposing my knees to the gulls. They skitter after me, hoping I will share my breakfast with them. I drop the clams into the pail of water I left to heat in the coals, and O'Neill sits up and rubs his eyes. Still, we do not speak. Not as we eat, nor as we fold the turtle's treasures into the blankets, nor as we mount the horses, nor when we stop at midday to rest on a riverbank. Unable to bear my filthy state any longer, I leave O'Neill while he is napping. I walk until I find a bend in the river where I can remove my dress in privacy. I scrub it against a smooth rock and then lay it on the beach to dry. In my chemise, I wade into the water until it reaches my neck. I wash my hair and body with my hands. And finally, I weep. An hour later, I return to the place where I left O'Neill to find him pacing and running his hands through his dirty hair. "You would feel better after a bath," I say. "I found a good place just over there."
"Clara!"
he shouts.
"You frightened me. I thought you'd left."
"I'm sorry," I say. "But why would I leave you?"
"Because I failed you. I did not save Marin. I let your sister be taken by the merfolk."
"It is what she wanted. I have told you 100 times, but you have not listened." I sit down on a boulder and lay my hands in my lap. "Now Marin is well, and she is home. And we will go to our home and live with Auntie and Scarf. Next year, we may visit Marin and hear her stories of seahorses and starfish and underwater courts." I speak to convince him and myself that these things are both true and good.
"Yes,"
he says. Only he does not sound convinced, not one bit. He sits at my feet and wraps his arms about his knees. Suddenly, he looks all of 12 years old. "You must not blame yourself for things beyond your control, O'Neill. It is one of your most irritating faults." Through my pain, I smile at him, and he smiles back. It is like the sun coming out after 100 days of rain.
"I was not aware that I had more than one fault,"
he says. "Well, your stench is one." I wave my hand in front of my nose. "Please, for the love of mercy, go and wash yourself."
"Just because your sister is a princess does not make you the queen,"
he says. He tosses a small rock at my bare foot. And then he obeys. The world will continue, as it has for thousands upon thousands of years. We will live without our dear Marin. We will finish growing up, and we will work and play and love. The sun and moon will take turns shining. Clouds will sail across the skies, and rain will wash the earth. I will touch snow and smell flowers. Perhaps someday I will have a child, and I will tell her of her mermaid auntie. Or perhaps I will become a stork and fly wherever the winds take me. I wish I were a stork and not a girl without a sister. In the nearby town, we use the Sea King's coins to purchase a covered wagon, clothes, horse tack, cooking supplies, food, soap, and a tent. That night, we camp in a meadow beneath 1,000,000 stars and a fat moon.
"I feel as rich as any king,"
O'Neill says, patting his full belly. His tone is cheerful, but his eyes are swollen and red from shedding countless tears. "Does your wound bother you?" I ask.
"No,"
he says.
"There is no sign of it, not even a scar to boast of."
I pour tea into 2 earthenware mugs. That is good. He looks at me strangely as I hand him his mug.
Clara?
Yes.
I promised you, in a letter brought to you by a very fine raven, that we would dance together. And the dancing Jasper forced us to do does not count.
Drink your tea, O'Neill, I say, before it gets cold.
A man must keep at least some of his promises.
He sets his mug onto the ground, then he takes mine and sets it beside his. I do not want to dance, I say, as he grabs my arm and pulls me away from the fireside. My heart races like a spooked pony. He begins to hum and steers me through the wildflowers and weeds.
Dance, Clara, do not just clomp along.
I pull away from him.
I do not wish to dance.
Hurt and disappointment are in his eyes. Even the moonlight reveals that much. I turn my back, afraid my face will shame me by exposing my true feelings. I have surprised myself. I had thought that my grief had erased the last vestiges of my unsisterly love for him, but I love him still. I love him terribly and completely.
Clara,
he says,
why do you turn away from me?
I do not reply. He takes my arm and spins me around to face him again.
Do you not know?
Gently, he lifts my chin and forces me to look into his sparkling eyes. Suddenly, I do know. He does not need to say the words, but miracle of miracles, he does.
I love you, Clara.
But you love Marin. That was why you tried so hard to save her, I say.
Of course I love her. We have been together since we were babies. But I have never loved her the way that I love you. The way I have always loved you.
I shake my head. But I saw you with her so many times. The way you looked at her. The way she looked at you.
She did love me. She wanted me to marry her. Asked me more than once. Bold as brass in that way she had. I told her that I loved her only as a sister, although she never accepted it. When I sat with her, when I held her hand, it was only to comfort her in her suffering. I would have done the same for Auntie or Osbert. I had planned to tell you in March, even Madame Vedoma knew. But when I arrived and saw Marin and she demanded my attention, things did not go as planned.
You kissed me, I say, in the forest.
That was not just for Jasper's sake, Clara. I had waited years for that moment with you.
All of my manners flee as I grab him by his shirt front and pull him to me. I kiss him shamelessly and long. Finally, he steps back. With gentle fingers, he wipes the tears from my cheeks.
Come with me,
he says. He leads me by the hand back into the camp.
It's here somewhere,
he says, rummaging through the crate full of the Sea King's gifts.
Ah, here it is.
He kneels before me and slips a ring onto my finger.
Will you be my wife?
He asks. The Sea King's rubies and gold glimmer in the firelight, and O'Neill's eyes reflect the flames.
After your forward behavior this evening, you must say yes.
Yes, I say. In the next town, at the next church. I kiss him again, and I swear I can hear the mermaid's sweet songs even though we are miles from the ocean. How can one heart be so full and so empty at the same time? I shove him away suddenly.
O'Neill,
I say, panicking.
I cannot marry you. What if I become a stork? It could happen at any time, perhaps even tomorrow.
He laughs.
You are no stork, Clara. You are no more a stork than I am an apple.
But Auntie said a stork brought me to her, and after what happened to Marin...
It was Scarf,
he says.
It was Scarf who found you and took you to Auntie.
But Auntie cannot lie, and she said it was a stork.
Scarf's given name is Ezra Corachrian Scarf. Corachrian means stork. It was his Scottish mother's family name. He found you on the steps of an abandoned orphanage.
Why did they never tell me? All this time I have dreaded growing feathers and a bill.
Your story was so unromantic compared to Merrin's and mine. They wanted you to feel special too, to have some magic of your own. None of us thought you actually believed you would become a bird. How could you have kept such a worry to yourself all these years?
I did believe it. I was resigned to it, in fact. But I would much rather be your Clara. I have seen enough magic, I say. And what does it matter where my journey began, as long as I end it with you? O'Neill takes both my hands.
I feel foolish, you know. Almost as if I ought to ask for your pardon.
For what could you possibly require pardon?
I swore to save Merrin and to protect you. But you were the hero, weren't you? You were the one who made me brave when I might have given up. You were the one who stood up to Jasper without knowing Osbert would come to your aid. You used the healing blade to save me. You made sure Merrin reached the ocean alive. You were your sister's hero. And you are mine. My brave, brave Clara.
A blush warms my face, and for once I do not mind. How could I have been brave if you had not been beside me?
You would have been.
In silence, we watch fireflies rising up from the grass like little freely moving stars. And I think about not being a stork. About never becoming a stork. Yet I have changed. I have left childhood behind. And it is true. I have been braver than I thought I could be. It is all fine and good being brave, I say as the moon peeks out from behind a cloud. But could we take turns at being the hero? It is a lot of work, you know.
I rather like being the damsel in distress,
O'Neill teases.
I was about to ask to borrow a dress.
Never! I shove him hard and he rolls into the grass, and we laugh as we have not laughed in months. As I never thought we'd laugh again. Chapter 30. With one hand, O'Neill wraps the brass door knocker against the wooden parsonage door. With his other hand, he clenches my hand. His palm is damp, and I suspect it is not from the heat of the day. Even a willing groom is likely to have nerves just before his wedding. He knocks again, and we wait. What if no one is at home? I say. Perhaps someone else in the town could marry us. A judge or a justice of the peace.
Hello?
A voice calls from behind us. We turn around to find a black-robed priest carrying a basket brimming with blueberries.
I was in the gardens and did not hear you arrive.
Good afternoon,
O'Neill says.
My name is O'Neill and this is Clara. We would be most grateful if you'd marry us, Father.
His words come out in a rush. His nervousness is most endearing.
O'Neill, you say?
The priest grins, showing all three of his teeth.
Isn't that a wonder? My name is O'Neill, Patrick O'Neill, although I'm called Father Patrick by most.
He brushes past us and opens the door.
Come in, come in. My housekeeper's gone away to see her son, so don't mind the dust.
He takes us to the kitchen and gives us cups of cool water and bowls of blueberries doused with cream.
Lad,
he says, leaning close to O'Neill,
you put me in mind of someone.
Perhaps we have met before. My guardian and I are traveling merchants and might have stopped here, although I do not remember it.
O'Neill says. He spoons the last of the blueberries into his mouth. Cream runs down his chin, and he wipes it away with his hand.
Glory be, the priest says. That birthmark. Now I know you, lad.
O'Neill fingers the heart-shaped birthmark on his chin.
I was an orphan.
Yes, yes, you were. It was in Virginia, my parish, near my childhood home. And I found you under the apple tree where my brother was buried. A babe with a birthmark, just like he'd had.
Your brother Seamus,
O'Neill says.
My guardian has told me the story many times. He named me O'Neill for your brother because he did not think I looked like a Seamus.
He raised you well, Father Patrick says. That I can see, even with these old eyes. Glory be to the Lord who doth provide.
His face is alight with happiness.
And here you are with your fine young lady, asking to be wed. I am blessed to witness this day.
Seeing the priest's joy makes my heart sing. Everything that has happened in our lives, from O'Neill's babyhood under the apple tree until now, has worked together to lead to this one perfect day. Will you marry us, Father? I ask. Today?
It would be quite unorthodox, without bans or special dispensation. I am sure my superiors would not approve. But how could I refuse the boy with my brother's birthmark?
Father Patrick marries us in the parsonage garden, beneath an arbor of fragrant pale pink roses. The gardener, his 5-year-old daughter, and her crooked-tailed kitten are our witnesses. O'Neill and I exchange rings we found among the Sea King's treasures. Gold bands that are perfectly sized and matched, as if the Sea King had somehow known our future. Perhaps he had. The little girl claps when we seal our vows with a kiss, and the kitten startles and runs to hide in the hedges. Come here, I say to the girl. I take a pearl from my pocket, one of 3 I kept from Marin's jar to remember her by. My sister gave this to me, and it is very special. Keep it so that you may always remember this happy day.
Is it a treasure? She asks.
Yes, I say. A very great treasure. It came from sadness, but led to joy. O'Neill kisses my cheek.
Mrs. O'Neill's scarf,
he whispers in my ear.
You are sweet and kind, as well as brave.
I do not know if I am any of those things, I say. But I am happy.
Not as happy as I am.
Do you pick a fight with me so soon? 5 minutes after the wedding. He quiets me with a kiss. If that is how he chooses to win our arguments, so be it. Chapter 31. Smoke funnels out the chimney of the cottage where I was raised. Twilight is upon the mountain, and the lamplight glows golden through the windows. How they knew we were coming, I do not pretend to know. But as the horses halt, Auntie and Scarf spill out the door and run to us. Osbert scampers at their heels, howling with wyvern delight. Kisses and tears are exchanged in abundance.
She is safe, our Marin,
Auntie asks, gripping my elbows.
Safe with her Sea King father, I say, and she is happier and more beautiful now than you could ever imagine.
For that I am glad, Auntie says, and I am glad you are home safe as well.
Hear, hear,
Scarf agrees. O'Neill lifts my hand to show them my rings.
We are married, I say,
blushing as befits a bride.
By the very priest who found me under the apple tree,
O'Neill says.
That is a story you will enjoy, Scarf and Auntie.
So young,
Auntie clucks her tongue.
But no matter, it was meant to be. We have always known it, haven't we, Ezra, my love?
Overcome with emotion, Scarf replies by gathering O'Neill and me into his arms again. His eyes and beard are wet with joyful tears.
All our children are safe and happy,
he says.
Who could wish for more?
After breakfast the next morning, O'Neill leads me to the wishing pool. His face shines with love and mischief.
Look,
he says. He points to the tree whose vandalized trunk has always warned us of the fruitlessness of wishing. Someone has changed the words. Swishing gets you nothing? Honestly, O'Neill.
Well, I couldn't leave it as it was. It was a lie. Besides, I made a solemn pledge to my true love that I would destroy it, and I could not bear to burn the poor tree down.
It was a lie, I agree. Sometimes wishing gets you something.
Wishing got me everything, he says. Eventually.
I dive into the deep water of the wishing pool, new dress and all, just as my sister would have done. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Mermaid's Sister by Carrie Ann Noble, performed by Kate Rudd, directed by Adam Tatro. Performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio, all rights reserved. The Mermaid's Sister is also available in print from Amazon Children's Publishing. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.